Hey, 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 this is the PhD cast. Thanks for joining us again. This week we're binging, but none of that naughty winter food. No, TV. A new breed of television show is emerging that's using every trick in the book to keep us coming back for more. We talk binge viewing and changing consumer TV habits. Also this week, it's a boy. How did brands and marketers celebrate the arrival of young Prince George? Plus, how Nestle is monitoring students' brainwaves while eating KitKat to prove that taking breaks is actually good for you. All that and the latest from MI9, this is the PhD Cast. Thanks for joining us. This week, podcast regulars, Nicola Davey.
Hi.
And Stuart Gurney.
Hello.
And we're joined by Mimi Lou. And also a podcast virgin, Nelly Pardini. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Has everybody had good weeks?
Yeah, really good, thanks.
Highlights of the week so far for everyone?
Royal baby!
Yeah. Nicola's Demi Moore lookalike.
So what we'll do is we'll make sure that the photograph that accompanies the podcast today demonstrates Nicola's costume today. and there's been lots of talk about Nicola is channeling who?
Demi Moore in Ghosts.
Specifically
in Ghost. And if anyone didn't get Ghost, how are we helping them get this, Stu?
This is my dream.
The unmistakable sound of Ghost there. And talking of, well, from movies to TV, The Age report not too long ago in an article about binge viewing. Carlton Cuse, who's one of the Lost writers, said, it's like the people who make potato chips. They know how to put the right chemicals in there to make you want to eat the next potato chip. Our goal is to make you want to watch that next episode. Addictive TV, and of course, changing media platforms and changing media habits mean that when you want to get into a program, you can watch as much of it as possible. And this has been christened binge viewing. The Age reports that scores of breathless critics have christened it as such. It's common amongst younger viewers, especially, who'd rather screen their favourite shows online, on demand, or on a digital video recorder than wait around for them to air once a week on old-fashioned television. First you fall for a show, and then you watch it endlessly. Why? Because you can. Guys, binging on TV shows, how new is this? Is this a brand new trend, or has this been coming for a while?
I think it's been around for quite a while. We've always, as you, regular listeners to the podcast will know, we talk about Game of Thrones on a weekly basis. So it's a great example of that. It's just, as you said, yeah, tapping into the opportunity of stuff being on demand increasingly, impatience in consumers, but also the changing narrative arcs and the way that TV producers are creating different, more intense, more complicated narrative structures that get us more involved. So I think I remember, which book was that? I think Good TV's Bad for You, or there's a really good book around that, and it talks about how if you compare a TV show in the 80s versus a modern TV show, the narrative arc and what happens in that 30 minutes of content is very, very different, because we've gone from quite an ABC linear structure to a really complicated, within a 2 minute space of any kind of narrative, you can have about four or five different storylines. I mean, the same Game of Thrones is exact great example of that. You can sit there. You have to sometimes sit there with a map, don't you? And quite often I'll text those of my friends going, who is that again? Should I know who that is? Because there's a very complicated narrative structure that we're now more lean forward to.
I remember when Lost started.
Yeah.
And that was probably the first kind of brand of content that I really recall being, where everyone became really addicted to it and you couldn't escape conversation about Lost. I've admittedly never actually watched an episode of Lost in my life. I was, I think, still safely tucked into Home and Away or something by that stage, but I was. It was a bit too scary for me, but I think ever since things like Lost, it's just been production values have got much higher. Like we said, the narrative and the complexity behind storylines have gone, and the complexity behind characters have increased, and people's expectations now, they expect to have kind of movie theatre in a 45-minute.
Well, also it's a really interesting opportunity for advertisers as well. So if you think about now, there's binging of content. If there, it's not necessarily about advertising being the disruptor of that of linear content. It becomes potentially the aggregator. So that's a great opportunity. So if, I don't know, for example, Ferrero brought you Game of Thrones. I keep going back to Game of Thrones. I apologise. That's the only thing I can think of. But if Ferrero could aggregate that content, not disrupt it, but somehow enhance it, that binge experience, that's a really powerful role for advertising and communication.
Especially, presumably, if you've got to pay for that content now. So if I've got to pay for that content to watch, say, House of Cards on iTunes, it could be that some kind of brand sponsorship which allows me to watch series one of that this month for free, and it replaces that. Is that a viable option, Nels?
Well, see, I was thinking a lot about this, and a lot of the time when you have like a binge content, it is happening illegally, which obviously limits the impact for advertisers and ability to go into there. So in my mind, you know, it does create opportunities around catch-up TV and perhaps things like additional content. So going back to Game of Thrones, you know, if you download Game of Thrones from iTunes, there's an extra feature around season recaps. There's information around marriages in the Middle Ages and, like, making of. So that's something that once you binge and it's over and you need something else, like, you're more likely to go into some other type of content. So I thought that was a really good opportunity. And obviously, pay TV guys have been on board for a long time with things like marathons over, like, long weekends and things like that. So it's a great opportunity for people, you know, who not necessarily haven't downloaded or don't want to pay for download and who want to do it legally to sponsor that content. But I think it also comes to another point for advertisers around what the messaging implications are, because these type of things tend to be people that are loyal watchers, so therefore in terms of a frequency perspective, you know, you constantly need to have new messaging, because otherwise it gets boring, and then people that are watching the show also want that new news and those surprises in line with what they're seeing in the show.
Mimi, is this something that we look for in terms of planning, in terms of these kind of opportunities or different ways to build schedules around brand opportunities?
Certainly it's got sliding opportunities in the sense that we can actually think about whether or not we concentrate on the launch or the teaser of the actual TV show, because that itself is another story to be told, and there's another storyline that is going to be different to the actual series. And it has implications on how these series are distributed, in the sense that the way they tease the audiences, how we can be involved in that, and how each of the little bite-sized content, and just like the Game of Thrones, we keep going back to that, and the giant skull that kind of used...
Spoiler alert.
Sorry. What?
What's giant skull?
Oh! There's a giant skull.
Stop talking now.
Is it in the TV series?
No, it's a... advertising.
Yes, an advertising.
Oh, thing. Okay, cool. Yeah. Sorry,
I missed a giant skull.
I've already seen season one.
Oh, well, biggest spoiler. Anyways, there's dragons.
I look forward to the giant skull.
So the giant skull, dragon skull, on the beach, just randomly there, and everyone's just like, oh my god, there is a real dragon and all of that. It's very disruptive. So, in the sense that they're actually doing like things like transmedia storytelling in the real world, but then people can't actually, they're kind of bringing that story to life.
You can, because you've got such loyal viewers, so you understand the narrative and every nuance of it, which you don't. But that, I mean, that's great for the content providers. I guess the challenge is advertisers can't necessarily, well, find it hard to tap into that. I think I'd like to go back to something Nelly was talking about in terms of marathons, because, like, you're right, actually, the trend's been around for ages. We've had TV marathons of series happening for ages now, but for me this trend feels a little bit different to that, because it's uninterrupted and it's completely on demand, and I think that is what makes it specific. So it's about being able to at any point during the day, and everyone's done it, it's been a rainy Sunday afternoon, you like just whack on a whole box set of something completely indulgent and you really get into it, and that is a completely different lean forward experience to a marathon. So it goes back to my original point about, I don't think the opportunity for advertising is about push in this space. It really has to be about aggregation and providing additional content opportunities.
I also think, though, one thing we have to remember is this type of binge TV doesn't apply across all genres. If you think about things like documentaries, sport, news and reality, where things become old news really quickly, that is never going to really have the same trend following
Speak
it.
Speak for yourself. I often dig out the old box sets of Big Brother season 2 or 3 and then just spend a quality afternoon watching old Big Brothers.
And my final point, I suppose, on this is around reach and thinking about what the reach implications are. So we always talk about broad audiences, big programs, having 1+ reach. But my question to people is episodic TV then becoming the new low involvement TV? It's an interesting thought that I sort of had in terms of reality programs might drive 1+ reach because it's more around the nowism and people have to understand the water cooler stuff. But then is the old, you know, CSIs and things you jump in and out of, are they just now becoming the low involvement thing that you watch in the background?
CSIs and Game of Thrones are completely different two genres in my mind, anyways, as a consumer. Because CSIs, if you say, did you watch the last episode of CSI, which one? It's very kind of, all the episodes start blurring together, whereas Game of Thrones is actually very kind of, as Nicholas said, very movie-like TV series, where if you just miss it and you don't watch it at the same pace as everyone else, then you're just going to fall behind. And
maybe, but I don't know, because I think CSI used to be like that. It used to be very lean forward as well. It just, I think in 5 years' time, Game of Thrones will be the same thing. It'll be like, which episode have you seen? I think it's basically that's more about the expiration date of content versus anything else. And I think it's a really interesting point around actually we're going to have to start building TV plans based on not necessarily genres, but actually people's relationships to that type of programme. Actually feels like a really interesting opportunity for advertising. So yeah, you might have to have a lean forward element. You might have to have a push recency 1+ element. There might be other elements you can start to have real time planning, for example, within your TV strategy. So it really kind of broadens open what AV tends to mean, and no longer are we seeing the kind of divergence of just push communications is actually imminent.
And then the final thing I think on that is it then ends up becoming responsibility of the TV networks to not be thinking about them being as a network, but being about that content aggregator and actually getting the access to the next big property that's going to have that audience binging on that kind of content, and finding what their role is, and then how they can sell on a role to advertisers as well, I think is
up next this week. It seems like only months since we watched them get married, but this week saw William and Kate give birth to It's a Boy. And not too many Republicans on the podcast today then. And brands were there to help celebrate. A whole range of brands, including Starbucks, Oreos, and a whole range of other ones were there to capture and celebrate the moment in what is, I suppose, is known as real-time marketing or real-time advertising. Let's try and stay focused on the brands and marketing and media implications of this event, rather than the fact that the baby's called George, which is a really cool name, I thought. George Alexander...
Louis.
Wow.
I think there's...
French Revolution. Interesting.
It's really very powerful names.
Mm.
Louis.
I think there's varying degrees of success in terms of the advertising.
The naming.
And how much...
Right,
and,
yeah.
I love Nelly just bringing us back to topic.
Come on, Nelly. keep us focused
on
now.
Task.
So in terms of, I think there's varying degrees, and I suppose it's hard, because obviously relevance is really important, and some of them are less clever plays on words and puns versus actual real integration.
So, for anyone who hasn't seen it, what are the kind of things that brands did, and what did they do in the moment that it was announced?
So a lot of it was congratulations, obviously, so a lot of the alcoholic brands jumped on it, especially the Mums and the Myers and stuff. And the airlines... We've got obviously all of the baby products and baby brands like Johnson & Johnson.
There's also Ryanair, but for those don't be confused, it's Ryanheir. So Ryanair. We're Free Infants Tuesday for Prince and Tuesday and Wednesday for Princess, coming from Ryanair, which is quite nice. You've got Mum, you've got Play-Doh, you've got
Mum
Smurfs,
champagne.
You've got a load of airlines in there. Air New Zealand for one. There's a lot of Visit Britain. One of my favourite was Blink Box, which is a Look Who's Talking Baby, Look Who's Trending, which I thought was quite a cute one. You wouldn't forget Cadbury with a little bundle of joy. So there's quite a few.
So it seems like it's easier to count the brands that didn't get involved.
Yeah.
And
B&Q, goodness.
What did B&Q do?
They changed the Royal Gates to kids' gates. Isn't that like treason?
Yeah, I think I think that might be some as a stretch. So it's easy to count the brands that didn't get involved. What were the media platforms for this? Is this Twitter? Is this Facebook? How did they get Instagram?
Even print.
Even print.
Yeah, and I mean, it's really interesting because you talked about real-time planning, and this is probably the most anticipated, almost anti-real-time planning example of real-time planning.
Well, it's real-time but incredibly predictable.
Exactly.
Which means that more brands can more easily do it.
So it's not about being nimble, it's about having some pre-worked out creative and media buy, to be honest, and then activating it when we knew it was going to happen. I guarantee most of these probably have boy/girl creative in the pipeline, and they've just implemented whatever one has actually happened.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why I kind of, you know, I like them. They're funny, and I think the role of these bits of communication are clearly just to entertain and to raise a smile and to embrace a societal kind of hoo-ha in a positive way. And so,
societal hoo-ha.
You've heard it here first. A societal hoo-ha. You'll all be using it next week.
Will that be the topic of your first book on cultural anthropology?
Yeah, societal hoo-ha.
The emergence of cultural hoo-has.
Yeah.
And all who sail in them.
Okay, how else would you phrase it then if it's not a hoo-ha?
Cultural meme?
Moment?
Phenomenon?
Exactly. Hoo-ha wins hands down. And so I kind of think I expect more when you can be that prepared and when you can be.
Yeah.
I actually expect more because you can't give points for first mover, or you can't give points to the way that you could give points to Oreo for during the Super Bowl, that because it's predictable. You know, they've had.
So for anyone who doesn't know, talk us through, because a lot of this does go back to the success that Oreo saw at the Super Bowl. For anyone who doesn't know what that was, what did Oreo do at the Super Bowl that was so successful?
So Oreo had a team, had a crack team working. A crack team hoo-haring all together. they did have a crack team. And when Melissa Bonds was talking about Twitter during Umbrella 360, she was talking about how they could activate something so quickly. And I think it was 6 minutes, if I'm not mistaken, it took them to get that bit of communication out there. And it was really important that you actually had all of the people in the room that need to make decisions, from lawyers to the client, from the client to media to creatives, all in a room so that they could act really responsibly and quickly. So as soon as that moment in the Super Bowl, which is completely unpredictable, very unlike the birth of Prince George, when that blackout happened, within 6 minutes, they were the first brand that could actually get something out there that was completely contextually relevant for that societal hoo-ha that was happening at the time. And they went out with a tweet pic that was simply an Oreo with a little nibble on it and a strapline of "You can dunk in the dark," which is brilliant. And you can applaud them for it because it was smart, it was clever. I know you're laughing at me, Chris.
I'm only laughing because the explanation of what Oreo did in the Super Bowl will be a third of the podcast.
Sorry, but for people who didn't know it, then they need to know. Anyway, that's what it was.
That's what it was. And so all of this comes from that. And so this is kind of like a moment in time where brands kind of go, we can do this, it's feasible, it has scale, let's jump in. And is there a bit of bandwagon to this?
I think there's one person that's done pretty well, and that's The Sun in the UK, The Sun newspaper. I absolutely loved their historic cover they ran on the 23rd, which changed their masthead from The Sun to The Sun, S-O-N, which I think is a really amazing
way. You're loving a pun today, aren't you, Nelly?
Well, it's not me. The people are saying, well, that's the content. I'm just talking about the content. The other thing they've done, which I love, was the double-decker bus, which had Congratulations, Will and Kate, with the beep for the baby in the back. And a part of what they're trying to do, and they took elongate and extend it, is actually make a lot of messages so people can write in the messages, write in the banners, and then collect that up for Wills and Kate. So I think it's a great way of like having a piece of comment, but also extending it on and actually creating content from it.
Mimi, is this sustainable, or is this, will we be over this next month?
I think only if the actual behaviour is instilled, like the Oreo, and it's a long-term behaviour they've been trying to do since the beginning of the year. Yes, it's sustainable for Oreo. However, other brands who have jumped on board, like not Starbucks per se, but other things like Johnson & Johnson and all the other mums and champagne brands and stuff, they'll be forgotten after this event is done and dusted.
One example that I did think was consistent with their ongoing brand messaging was P&G, which I think they cut through for me. I didn't see it in real life. I've obviously just seen it in a, you know, Mashable report. But what cut through for me was, instead of being entertaining or funny or using puns, they actually continued and with their celebrating mums and kind of brought it back to actually congratulations to all the parents of new of girls and boys. And so a kind of a bit worthy, to be honest, my personal opinion. But you've got to applaud.
But you know,
them.
If you can't be worthy around a hoo-ha, when can you?
Exactly.
You're not
but they were consistent. What I mean is that I think that they were consistent with their brand proposition, and so they didn't allow a cultural hoo-ha to just derail them to do something entertaining or you know, out of the blue. So I did think that their tone cut through.
Look, the only thing that's going to trump this is if the Queen actually hands over the crown to Prince Charles. Like, that's going to be the next big piece of news.
That is going to be a hoo-ha and a half, mate.
A hoo-ha and a half.
Just so hoo-ha squared. Mimi's point. I actually think that all this is an example of a deluge we're going to get from every cultural hoo-ha, and that's going to be really annoying. And I think we've missed. Like, the Oreo example was it. Like, I don't think anyone can now tap into that level of immediacy in real time.
Exactly.
Well, genuinely, because what's going to happen?
Unless that is your comm strategy. So for Oreo, their comm strategy, the platform, is all about reacting to real-time events and embedding Oreo in that, right?
But now we're going to get to saturation where everyone's going to have that as their comm strategy. Therefore, it becomes less impactful.
Exactly.
So we're just going to be... It's going to become a gimmick, to be honest. So I'm not saying real-time marketing is a gimmick. It's an interesting space. But this, how brands are mimicking the Oreo model is effectively going to end, and it is a gimmick. So
yeah,
I think
continual tactical planning is not a comm strategy.
No, exactly.
Now, I do remember one
other example,
though, and it was 3 years ago. It was 3 years ago. It was also a print execution, and it was by IKEA, and it was after Kevin Rudd got ousted, and they did a really good tactical cabinet. So I think that it has been here for a while, and obviously just with newer media it's making
it is interesting that something that does bring people back to print, because most of these times these things run in print because it's quite immediate, quite fast and visual.
Back to print from
it's people actually buying print as well as digital, where previously, you know, because it is still the news medium.
I think that one's going to run and run. Right, also this week, Nestle, they have been monitoring students' brainwaves, specifically whilst eating a Kit Kat. And what they've been able to do is prove that taking breaks is good for you. So this all happened in Singapore, and they used electroencephalographs to measure brainwaves when people were eating Kit Kats. Guys, what do we make of this use of electroencephalographs in media and marketing?
I don't really mind that doing, but I don't think
electroencephalograph again.
Yeah, I don't think I won't.
Can we use that to measure who?
A who
has?
She probably could.
Who who's?
Not
who. But maybe explain better than me what happened.
I just think that they don't... Sure, they can prove that taking breaks is good for you, and obviously that is the slogan of what Kit Kat, or the brand position that Kit Kat's going for, but there's plenty of other brands that actually is probably more relevant to try and prove that point for their brand, like all of the coffee brands, or any, like, I think there was a cup of soup brand, or
Pepsi Max. Take a break, have a Pepsi Max.
Pepsi Kick as well, if you
Pepsi Kick. Or a Ferrero Rocher. Couldn't buy something on eBay.
Absolutely.
And I do think the whole campaign, there's two parts, and there's a bit of a disconnect. So there's a part where they kind of put weird machines on people, students. And then there's a second part where they get students to do the whole smile cam, and they have a smile off, which I just don't see the connection of taking breaks. And
then, maybe correct me wrong, but you also, when you worked out the way your brain looked when you're during this break, you could also print that onto bags and things like that for students, like as an image, which I think is a bit random as well.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's obviously the brainchild of some PR company who are trying to generate some earned media. Not going to lie. Don't want to look at me like that. You were thinking it as well.
I was thinking it was a proof point to follow up their previous campaign for results for
award
entry.
Yeah, that would have been the brief. But no, it feels very like, we've got a long-term strategy. How can we create a conversation around it? So let's try and find a funky way to do that, which is a tried and tested PR strategy. So It feels very, very simple. It won't last long. It's a gimmick. It's a little bit.
But
of
it's
a,
years after the campaign. Like, they had this campaign, which won
perhaps,
the award,
but
and that's coming up.
But perhaps it took years to get the electroencephalograph up in my
head. I reckon it did.
But like, that's not the campaign, though. Their whole ownership of the Take a Break territory isn't just a campaign. It is the intrinsic to their brand proposition. So to keep reinvigorating that isn't a bad strategy for them. That makes perfect sense.
But does it in the article say whether it was just them taking a break or taking a break with the chocolate? I don't know if there was a differentiation there.
Well, as we know, if you follow the brain, everyone has the engram of Kit Kat that's got Take a Break in there, because it's, as you said, it's been around for such a long time, so it doesn't really matter if they talk about chocolate, because I think the moment you start talking about taking a break and it's from Kit Kat, you've got the engram already there to be able to do that, so I don't think it matters particularly.
Cool, and finally this week, Nicola, you spent the morning in the company of MI9. What did we learn?
We did. I went over to the Connected Experiences Insights Breakfast, and it was a new research from MI9 identifying four different pathways of cross-screen behaviour. They claim for the first time it uncovers what is driving the trend and how it's changing the way publishers deliver content and brands are shifting marketing dollars. So I thought it was... I thought it was okay. I think it was talking about a lot of the stuff that we already know, like dual screening, multi-screening, bits of transmedia storytelling.
Omni-screening. Every screen.
Omni-screening.
My new one. You heard it here first.
Omni-screening.
We're getting a lot of exclusive on the podcast.
Yeah.
Right, you don't want to miss it this week.
That is going to be a cultural hoo-ha in itself, is
omni-screening.
So I have got some points, some positives and negatives of what we learned. So the four different pathways, they called content grazing, investigative spiderwebbing, social spiderwebbing, and quantum screening. Essentially, what they've done is really put motivations behind people's behaviour, which is good. So understanding how people's behaviour to use devices and really getting across that it's about content, not about, it's kind of platform agnostic and it's all just about content and how people want to access content that's important. So good to reaffirm that. And they've chunked a lot of stuff, they've chunked kind of like behaviours into small collectives, which is also easier to get a hold of and creates the common vernacular really to talk about when you're planning, which I thought was good. And it's also highlighted that producers, editors, writers and publishers really need to work together to think about how you tell this story, which comes back to the first point, actually, of today in terms of how content's getting created and aggregated across TVs. So the negatives, it was quite salesy. It would have been great, actually, to have seen how brands, not necessarily brands on their platforms or brands that they worked with directly, it would have been quite nice to have seen some epic fails on how brands have failed to do this, as well as seeing how advertisers that they work with on their own publishing platforms have done it so well. So I think that we all agree that you can learn a lot from things that have failed as well as things that have been
good. So you said there was a lot of truisms throughout this presentation.
Mm. There was a lot of truisms and...
Not a lot of insight.
I would have probably liked a little bit more insight. But as I said, the fact that things are kind of like chunked down into motivations and behaviours are good. And they were also talking about how they're working kind of across the 9 Entertainment group as well, obviously thinking about content aggregators and making sure that is cross-platform. So there was a bit of that connection.
Cool, and that's it for the PhD cast this week. A big thank you to Nicola Davey.
Hoo-ha!
And Nivy Lou.
Yay!
And Stuart Kearney.
Hoo-ha!
And Nelly Pardini.
Hoo-ha!
Sounds
like a cowboy.
Hoo-ha! Right, I've been Chris Stevenson. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back next week.
From the Duke and Duchesses of PhD.
Ridiculous.
Get more from PhD Australia. You can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or find us on Google Plus @PhD Australia.